Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is your New Year special of Science Weekly for January the 2nd. Coming up on this week's extra special podcast, we'll look ahead to the scientific breakthroughs over the next 12 months. We'll discuss the Large Hadron Collider at CERN and the future of synthetic biology. We'll ask if this is the year that we can truly tackle climate change, and we'll investigate some of the more ridiculous scenarios that our friends in white coats might dream up in 2008. Be prepared to boldly go where no pod has been before. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Yes, it's 2008, apparently. Really it is, and we're the first out of the blocks in the Guardian podcasting race. Joining me right here now on January the 2nd, 2008, in a manner that's in no way pre-recorded, Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample. How can you believe it's next year already? This year?
I hope you're enjoying the new year.
I'm loving it.
Isn't it
good? It's amazing. It's just like last year, this. The Guardian's environment correspondent is David Adam. Did you have a good time in Bali, David?
Yes, it was very good. Well, that seems a long time ago now.
It was last year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's right. And finally, the man who just can't stop podding, the Guardian's tech correspondent, Bobby Johnson. How's Tech Weekly coming along, Bobby?
We're many episodes into. Yeah, come on, give it time. Tech Weekly will kick
your... So your Facebook network is coming along?
I think we've got about 100 people so far in a week. I just think that's pretty good.
It's not bad.
What did you do for the New Year, Alok?
I was flying in a plane above the Atlantic.
Really?
Did you get all that you wanted for Christmas, Alok?
And more.
What did you get?
Reindeer and Rudolph turned up as well. Well, this show is all about the future, looking into what the most interesting stories of 2008 are going to be. We'll kick off with the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. Ian, you're the particle physics man on the desk. So take us give us a little bit of background on what this massive machine, which is going to switch itself on this year, what's it going to do?
Well, this is going to be the world's biggest particle accelerator, biggest subatomic particle smasher. And bear in mind that this will be at CERN in Geneva, and they've been without a big accelerator now for 8 years. So this is quite a delayed project that's coming online at last, we hope, in May. Before the delays till May, it was due to come on last autumn. Now everybody's crossing their fingers that it happens in May. And I think this is genuinely a really exciting time for physics, because we've had so much sort of slagging off of physics being in the doldrums last year and such like, that for something like the LHC to be coming online at last, they don't know what they're going to find. They certainly hope to find things like the Higgs boson, but whatever, they will find something, and it's very likely to be new physics. And, you know, it's going to run for 20 years.
It's already a bit delayed. It was meant to be switched on sort of November last year. Why has it been delayed? I mean, it's a ferociously complicated machine. It's been designed for 10 years, been under construction for 10 years, many billions of dollars. And tell us why it's been delayed.
Well, there's been all manner of reasons. I mean, you know, this is the most complex civilian construction project in Europe ever. And when you do something like that, you are going to have delays. You're not going to bring that in on time, and you're not going to bring it in on budget. And they've had a lot of things go wrong, and it's been just practicalities with building the damn thing. It's incredibly complex. I mean, the latest problems they have are with these superconductor magnets, which, completely unrelated, I'm sure, were manufactured at Fermilab, their prime contender out in Illinois. They didn't work properly when they were installed, and that
they exploded, didn't they?
Yeah, that brought in at least a 6-month delay. This is high-tech, you know, groundbreaking stuff, and it's all very new. I don't think anyone really
let's talk about
surprised that it's
a couple of the things that it's going to try and find. I mean, the big reason the LHC was commissioned was to try and find this Higgs boson. This is the particle that represents the Higgs field, which supposedly gives everything mass. Now, you went to meet Peter Higgs last year. I mean, not many people have sort of talked to him about it for years. What was his impression of the LHC? Was he excited that this is finally going to prove him right? If it is.
Well, it's funny, actually. And first of all, one of the very strong messages from Peter Higgs is that he's actually really gutted that things like the LHC, and previously to that, the really fated superconducting supercollider from the States, were sold as a Higgs finder. And he says, look, you're going to find great new physics and there's going to be some really interesting stuff there. You're really sticking your neck out by saying that we need to build this thing to find the Higgs, because if it turns out to be something else, and obviously the Higgs is what, you know, supposedly gives mass to all the other particles. If you find something else, then you run into these dangers of the politicians and the funding bodies thinking, well, what are these scientists on about? You know, we built this machine to find the Higgs, now they're telling us it's not there. So he's very cautious about that attribution.
Well, whatever they
in the
do
first
find,
place.
Won't they just call it the Higgs?
You would imagine, I mean, if they find something
they're
very similar
find
to his
a
mechanism,
particle,
I mean,
yeah.
It's the whole, yeah, I mean, the mechanism that he explained, and obviously other groups, I have to say, explained, described as well at the same time. I mean, it may well get his name and be called the Higgs boson.
Now, we mentioned it's a ferociously complicated machine, and hopefully it'll start in May. It's going to probably start at a very low energy to sort of test all the systems and so on, and then start making its measurements by the end of the year. Well, when do you expect we'll get the first sort of sign of the Higgs, do you reckon?
Well, I've talked to the chief scientist there quite recently, and he's saying, look, at the moment they're still cooling all down, and then they'll go through this period.
They're being cautious, but they're
being very cautious, but you... I don't know, I just have a sense of something that complicated, that big, you know, 27-kilometre radius this thing's in, the accelerator goes around, a lot of kit. You'd imagine there's going to be a fair bit of teething problems, a lot of sorting out software glitches, and I don't know, that's my fear, and that's maybe me being a pessimist. But if they get the thing up and running and smooth and getting good data by the end of the year, that'll be really nice. I think if it works first time, and they can grab data straight away, then it's going to still be 2009 before they can look for a signal for the Higgs, because they just need to get the stats. They need to get enough data points to be able to say, yes, we have a Higgs at this particular mass or what have you.
And then everyone's going to have to check it for a good while afterwards. Bobby, you've got a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering, because we were talking about it before we came on the air, folks, and it turns out I'm the only one in the pod who hasn't actually been to the LHC. I was just wondering, can you kind of paint a picture of what it's like to go inside?
Yeah. I mean, it's great. If you leave Geneva Airport and drive northwest towards the Jura Mountains, you'll drive along and you'll see a lot of rural countryside, a few villages, not much at all. It's pretty boring. But after a while, you're actually over it, and because it's 80 metres beneath the ground, and then you drive on a bit more and then you get to the whole sort of CERN HQ. But when you go down there, it's great. You get these sort of... You get in a huge lift that rattles down 80 to 100 metres, and then it's a cold, when I was there, huge tunnel. And you can walk around it before they get the thing sort of turned up and all cooled down and sealed off. You can walk around the tunnels a little bit. And the detector rooms, they have four huge detectors around the ring. Those rooms are huge. They're cavernous. I mean, they're just absolutely massive rooms.
They reminded me of the size of cathedrals almost, when you walk in.
Yeah.
They're sort of, it's like a huge enclosed space.
Absolutely staggering
and
size.
The biggest one, Atlas, is, I don't know how, 100 metres tall or something. And what's incredible about it is the size of it is like I said, a cathedral. But if you go close to it, the workmanship of every single solder, every single electrical circuit has been done by hand, because you can't make machines to make this stuff. And there are billions and billions of connections, and every single one of them has got to work, because you're looking for the smallest things in the world with possibly the biggest detector in the world. The scale is all kind of screwed up. Look, there's pictures, actually. There's pictures of the LHC detectors, everything, actually on the website, if you go to guardian.co.uk/science. And also, previous podcasts, we've had various people going around CERN giving their impressions, including the guy from Torchwood, is it?
John Barrowman,
that's right. So that's
Captain
all.
Jack.
That's all.
Or the face of Bo.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's all on the Guardian website. The second thing in our list of things to look forward to in 2008 is stuff going on in space. I mean, there's going to be loads of launches. Bobby, you've been looking at this. Give us a quick guide, quick and dirty guide to what's going up there.
I have been completely spaced out by this. Boom. No, actually, there's a lot of stuff going on this year. One of the most interesting is the Lunar Recon Orbiter, which is a NASA probe that's going to go up and spend a year circling around the moon, gathering details of the surface. Now, that kind of sounds not that interesting, really. But the reason it's intriguing is because that's part of the new plan to return people to the moon. So they're mapping out the surface.
You want
properly
to scout out places to
exactly,
land. Exactly,
exactly. So it's kind of it's a mission with a kind of really broad scope in the future. You know, we've heard a lot of talk about going back to the moon, but this is the first real solid action that's part of the vision for space exploration that's coming up. And that's already 4 years old now, that, you know, since they made the announcements there. So that's very interesting. The next one, which is let me say this correctly, Chandrayaan 1, which is India's first lunar probe. Now that's, you know, just think about that for a minute. India's first lunar probe. This could be an interesting development. I'm a bit weirded out by the pictures I've seen of it because it just looks like a small multicoloured box. It's just a bit like a Rubik's Cube.
What were you expecting it to look like?
Oh, you know.
Like a rocket ship.
Yeah, with lasers for eyes and
lasers
stuff like
for
that.
Eyes.
You know, yeah.
Arms.
They're spending £40 million on it, roughly.
Which is cheap.
Which is fairly cheap. And for our American listeners, with your exchangeably challenged currency, that's $80 million or 3.8 billion rupees, I believe. And that's going to do a fairly similar thing. I'm going to go up, scan the surface. It's going to examine composition of the moon's surface, particularly looking for water. And that's going to be followed up next year by Chandrayaan 2. Why do they always do that? Why can't they come up with a new name? But that will be a rover mission. So they'll send another rocket up and drop a rover on the moon's surface.
Well, what's interesting about this, though, is that you've got India, which is, you know, technologically quite, you know, advanced nation, spending quite a lot of money sending things to the moon for no practical benefits, as it might seem, but beyond the science. And as far as I know, they've got no military interests up there. But it does actually represent a whole sort of new set of nations going into space. I mean, I don't know if any of the rest of you had anything to say about this, but China going up, sending up astronauts. I mean, they've done it really quickly. The Americans are going to take another 15 years before they get anyone up onto the moon. Never mind getting people into space. I mean, the shuttle didn't go up. It's really complicated.
Well, it's a new space race, really, isn't it? Kind of proving that you're a kind of high-tech, developed nation. If you can get one over on the US, then brilliant. You know, that's what they're all aiming for.
I mean, never mind going to the moon and eventually to Mars as well. I mean, David, the observation of Earth is quite an important thing for space.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to remember that a lot of this stuff is looking outwards, but also a lot of what NASA does and what some of the stuff in space already is doing is looking back at Earth. We think that we know an awful lot about the world's environmental problems, but there's still an awful lot to know. In fact, they tried to send up a satellite to look at the polar ice caps a couple of years ago that blew up. I'm sure they're going to make progress on that again this year. I don't think it's going to go up this year.
Well, I mean, some of the world's top climate scientists are in NASA. Jim Hansen, for example, is based at one of NASA's institutes and is one of the leading sort of lights in describing and characterising climate change. Is it a big part of what they do?
Well, Earth observation was one of the founding principles for NASA. It has been downgraded a little bit in recent times. They tried to take it out of the NASA mission statement, actually, which some said was the Bush administration reflecting its priorities. But yeah, it's hugely important. And it's also, remember, it's one of the justifications for the amount of money that they spend on these things, is that both by directly observing the Earth, but also by developing this technology, we help to improve life on Earth.
Bobby, take us through a couple of other missions.
Well, actually, before we go there, I just wanted to ask you, because I know, you know, you're desperate to be Britain's first man on the moon. But, you know, could you take your Indian citizenship and become the first Indian?
No, I don't think they're involved in it. The Indian governments are involved in manned missions. So I think it's probably, yeah, you're right. It's probably been outsourced somewhere. I'm not sure. But no, every country I pretend to be citizens of, every single one of them adopts policies of no human spaceflight. But no,
they're following me, aren't they? Yeah,
they don't want me to go into space.
There are a few other things going up as well. A host of telescopes, including GLAST, which is the Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope. That goes up from Cape Canaveral at the end of the month. They say no earlier than January the 31st, and I think Ian knows all about what that really means.
We'll come back to that.
And that's going up and is looking at, you know, gamma rays, obviously, given the name, so we'll have a lot more information about supermassive black holes and all that kind of stuff.
Can you say that again?
Supermassive black holes.
Should always say black holes, like that from now
exactly. on. There's also, towards the end of the year, there's Kepler going up. That's named, of course, after Johannes Kepler, the famous astronomer who came up with the laws of planetary motion. That's a one-ton telescope that's going up and looking at the outer reaches of the Milky Way, looking for planets elsewhere in the solar system. Not our solar system, other people's solar systems, and looking for kind of Earth-sized planets. So,
other people's solar systems.
Hey, you know what I'm talking about.
Green men's solar systems.
it was a heavy new year. That's
it's all not
I
in my
say.
Solar system.
So maybe expect a slew of these kind of new Earth stories in about a year or so when they're looking up there. There's also Herschel, which is a huge telescope going up from the European Space Agency. That's got a 3.5 meter mirror, so it's the largest ever
launched
that's gone up there, and that slightly more boringly is looking at low energy light from the outer reaches of
bloody low energy light.
Well, you
so
know,
boring.
It's not other planets, is it? Come on,
is that a replacement for Hubble? Then is that going to do?
It's a bit of that. I mean, it's not going to look in optical wavelengths. It's going to be low energy infrared. But we'll wind that up. I think Bobby, stop, because otherwise you're going to keep going forever. There's actually an interactive guide on the Guardian's website looking at all of the stuff coming up in space in the next 10 years, I think.
This is so almost like you planned it.
I know it is, isn't it? It's like I've done all of it before. It's that's at guardian.co.uk/interactive.
Hi, folks. This is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly on Guardian Unlimited.
Number three on our list is climate change. Now, put your champagne down, boys, and let's get serious here. David, climate change in 2007, that was last year, it was when it became something that sort of got into the public consciousness, and the IPCC did its reports. It was a big year. What's it all about this year? Is it going to be the nitty-gritty of actually getting things done?
It's actually going to be something of a quiet year in climate change, though that won't be reflected with the amount of attention the subject will get again, because you might remember all the hullabaloo or ballyhoo, if you like, at the end of last year.
Ballyhoo. Oh, that's terrible.
Brilliant.
First joke of 2008. That's good.
Barley
excellent.
Pun.
When the UN got everyone together in Indonesia to discuss what they were going to do about it, and at the very last minute, they agreed what they call a roadmap. That is essentially working out the next Kyoto Protocol, working out how governments and countries are going to do something about it. It doesn't have to be agreed until the end of next year, 2009. And so in the very slow-moving world of climate politics, it means that nothing will be agreed, probably until the last day of the meeting in 2009. So what you will get this year is a lot of posturing. Domestically, it's very important. Certainly the US have got a lot of... They're going to have a new president by the end of the year, of course. There's also a lot of domestic legislation being considered in America.
Because these states in America, individually, they're doing some good things, aren't they, climate change-wise?
Some states have been for a while. We all know about California and the northeastern states. A lot of the cities have been. But critically, this year, we're going to see some serious moves on the federal scale. Congress are going to consider a couple of bills. Probably won't get through this year, but probably early next year, we're going to see the US passing probably a cap-and-trade law, which would be a major, major breakthrough. And critically, it would give the US a mandate to go into the 2009 negotiations with something they could sell at home, which they never had before.
That's quite positive, especially from the US front. I mean, is that partly because of the way that the Democrats are now controlling Congress? Is it because Bush is not going to be able to get his anti-climate change measures in? Is it harder for him now?
I think it is, yeah. Well, I think it's not just the Democrats. It's an all-party awareness. I mean, I think you do have to sort of cordon off the Bush administration in this argument, really, because they just have such a crazy one-sided ideological view on this that is not reflected across the party, certainly not across the country. So it's a combination of shifting awareness and the changing political ground in the US. But against that optimism, we should, of course, say that carbon emissions continue to rise and will continue to rise. So we are some way from being off the hook.
Ian?
I was just going to ask David, I mean, do you think there's going to be more of a shift in the kinds of stories that are written in the media about how we now cope with it? Because although it seems to have taken an awful long time, the getting the science out and the acceptance that climate change and global warming is actually real and that it's a significant issue. It seems, you know, now just certainly a talk with Britain's incoming chief science advisor, he was talking very heavily about one of his priorities wants to be finding ways of tackling climate change. So with David King, the previous chief science advisor, it was we have to get people to know about climate change. And there's been this shift forward. And I wonder if that's something that is going to maybe dominate the media a bit more this time around.
I think it probably is. It's hard sometimes to write stories about that because it can be quite dull sort of development capacity building. You know, you go
or engineering.
Well, yeah, that's the posh word. That's what politicians call engineering, is capacity building.
I see.
So walls, really, and drains and things like that.
Engineers will be very pleased with this bit. Walls and drains, that's what you do.
But I think the thing to watch out for this year is business. We've already started to see it stir. And once it starts getting a bit of momentum, there will be no stopping it. Look at the clean technology companies. Look at the carbon trading. Look at even the attitude of companies like Tesco's and Marks and Spencer's. And that's where you will start to see, if we're going to beat this problem, that's where the start of that will come.
And look at The Guardian too, with its Environment Weekly podcast. That's going to cut down carbon emissions like you wouldn't believe. Go on, Bobby.
So going back to the US, I mean, we've got at the moment, we've got an idea who the runners and riders are. You know, there are only potentially so many people that could become president. Do we have any idea where they all stand on the issue?
Well, certainly the two major Democrats have both been trying to put global warming central to their campaign so far. I think they are all making all the right noises. It's not quite as simple in the US as we think it is, because no matter what the president wants, it's up to the Congress and the House of Representatives to actually pass this stuff, which is why when Clinton helped to make the Kyoto Protocol, but knew he wouldn't be able to get it into law at home. And so it's not just about the president, it's about the shifting political landscape, but certainly all the signs are positive at the moment.
Well, we'll wrap that up there. And you can keep up to date with all of this stuff, of course, on the new Environment Weekly podcast. That's at guardian.co.uk/podcasts. Now let's change the mood slightly from the heavy stuff of climate change to the Science Weekly troubadour, Johnny Berliner, with his first song of 2008. This is The Future.
We'll all be driving flying electric cars in the future, in the future. Using stem cells to grow ourselves new arms in the future. In the future, we'll have our iPods and our telephones implanted deep within our bones, with holiday homes on the moon and Mars. In the future, in the future, in the future, we'll all be eating pills instead of meals. In the future, in the future, and cyber sex will feel a lot more real. In the future, in the future, we'll be designing every baby, have eradicated rabies, maybe we can reinvent the wheel. In the future, in the future, in the future. The future may be wonderful, the future may be terrible, the future is inevitable, the future. We'll be drowning when the water levels rise. In the future, and only folks who live on mountains will survive. In the future, and we'll never meet no aliens, 'cause they're too far away, but then we may work out how to walk the speed of light. In the future, in the future. The future may be wonderful, the future may be terrible, the future is inevitable, the future. We'll use only robot soldiers to fight wars. In the future, that way no one has to die for any cause. In the future, and while the battles are raging, we'll invent a cure for aging, but then kill ourselves with nuclear bombs for sure. In the future, in the future.
That was the excellent Johnny Berliner. You can hear more from him at myspace.com/Johnny Berliner, and I challenge you all not to be humming that all through the first week of 2008, which this is. And everyone here is humming it. Let's get on to the fourth thing, and I'll look forward to the rest of 2008. Synthetic biology, the idea that Craig Venter and his like might actually produce the first synthetic life form and other things involved with that. Ian, take us through some of this.
Well, this is a kind of a pretty seismic shift in biology, going from staring at stuff and looking at how it works to trying to really get to grips with it. defining it so well and getting a handle on it so well that you can actually break it down into a bunch of components. You can almost use them as off the shelf, and you can sort of bolt together different things and really construct, even construct biological circuits from the ground up. And that would just be, could be phenomenally powerful. And what I really like about synthetic biology is it's not quite clear where it's going. It just feels like GM 2.0. It just feels incredibly powerful genetic modification, and I think it's just, it's absolutely fascinating.
Is Craig Venter going to announce his first life form?
Well, what's really nice is it's not just Venter. We've known Craig Venter has obviously made a big deal about how he wants to create certainly wants to create artificial life, and he wants to create microbes which either have this minimal gene set, the very basic number of genes you need to actually constitute life, or he wants to produce those ones which have a few bolt-on genes that might help them produce hydrogen and stuff like that. And he said he wants the first trillion-dollar organism. I mean, he's obviously totally gung-ho about this. But he's not the only group doing this. I mean, you know, Venter's got some of the best people. He's got Ham Smith on board, you know, excellent scientist. But there are guys at Maryland University who are trying to do the same thing. They've built up their own artificial genome. They're going to put that into cells next year. And what they hope is that, just like a software into a computer, you put the DNA in and hope that the cells boot up and then they start replicating, and there you go.
I mean, there's some interesting uses that people are coming up with for stuff like this. I mean, it's still very early stages, but David, I mean, one of the things that Venter talks about is microbes to eat up carbon dioxide, for example, take it out of the atmosphere, or produce hydrogen as a fuel source. I mean, are these actually things that environmentalists think are decent ways to tackle climate change?
I think environmentalists are cautious about this because they see anything that is not straight cuts in carbon emissions as a bit of a dangerous distraction. And I think I spoke with Venter the end of last year for a piece that's coming out in the magazine this week, coming weekend actually. His minimum genome, his new life, gets all the attention, but he is doing some astonishing stuff with just the bugs that he's found. I mean, he's sifted the oceans and he's gone deep into the earth, and he's found a lot of stuff which already does amazing transitions and can transform CO2 into methane, and so although his synthetic stuff gets all the attention, I don't think we should overlook the fact that the more basic biology, he's just looked harder than other people, and he's found some amazing stuff, and that will bear fruit a lot quicker because he hasn't got to mess around with safety and licensing and containment and all that kind of stuff.
What about the people who kind of have problems with synthetic biology? You had commentators at the end of last year sort of harking to all sorts of potential problems with this, you know, runaway organisms that multiply and eat the earth somehow. It's all a bit similar to the problems people have with nanotech, isn't it? What do you make of people's problems with this?
Well, I think the whole Grey Goo idea, you know, Ray Kurzweil's, I mean, that's something which he himself has retracted, even though a lot of other people before.
This is the idea that little nanobots would kill the...
Yeah, it's the idea that you can design something, a nanoscale robot that replicates itself using raw materials and thereby just keeps doing that by digging around in the mud and making more and more of itself. And I think, you know, it's the sort of thing that concerns Prince Charles, but not too many otherwise sane people. But the idea with the microbes, a lot of people who are opposed to synthetic biology are opposed on an ideological front. They just don't like the idea of scientists playing God. And I know when we've talked to scientists before, they said things, you know, this wonderful quote, it's okay, yes, we're playing God, but we're only playing. You know, I think there's just a really nice sense of adventure and excitement about what they're doing. But I think, you know, some of the more credible worries that people have are that credible scientists will accidentally produce something which is really devastatingly bad. And there's a precedent for that. I mean, that's already happened. I mean, in 2001, some Australian government scientists were trying to produce a vaccine for mice for pest control. It was going to be a contraceptive vaccine. And they changed one gene and turned it into a virus that killed every mouse they put it into outright, completely devastating virus. And obviously, we've had the recreation of the 1918 Spanish flu virus, and polio as well. So there are, you know, you can see why people might be worried about an accident happening in a lab. I think the other concerns about these microbes getting out into the wild and running amok is maybe slightly alarmist, because a lot of these bugs will be so carefully designed to be work in a particular situation that you put them outside and they'll just wither and die.
They'll just be weeds. Yeah, Bobby?
Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, how this kind of very fundamental level of biology affects the study of genetics further up the tree? Will we see a sudden speeding up of projects working on the genome that we've seen and trying to work out, you know, what causes what disease and all that kind of stuff?
It's a fantastic tool, actually, isn't it, this? Because
you can now take,
not only try and work out what a gene does by knocking it out in mice, which is how we do it normally, but you can actually build up the gene and tweak it, see what it can do, isn't that right?
Yeah, but I think also that there may be, the idea of building up from the bottom might in sort of 5 years' time seem incredible hubris by synthetic biologists in a way, because a lot of the projects that have come out in genetics actually last year have just shown that it's far more complicated, that there's a load of unknowns in there. And the idea that you will then just be able to sort of break all this down, use it up like Lego, just feels incredibly simplistic. And obviously these people know that.
Isn't that what guys at MIT exactly are doing? I mean, BioBricks, for example, is Drew Endy and Tom Knight at MIT, a group that sort of invented synthetic biology, really. What they are doing is exactly that. They're building small components, a bit like microelectronic circuits components, and they're called BioBricks, and you plug these things together and they will do things, and there's thousands of them now.
I think it'll work better with biological circuits because they're much smaller things. But if you think of an entire organism, it has a whole layer of epigenetic stuff on top of it, a lot of methylation and a whole other different layers of programming going on how that genetic code is used. And I think if you're going to order genes over the internet, stitch them up in a lab into genomes, you've got to really understand what you're packaging the genes in and all the rest of it. It's certainly if you're going to get to the level of creating artificial organisms.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's you know, junk DNA isn't necessarily junk DNA.
As we've discovered this year.
It's there for a purpose. I also wonder how, you know, we've seen companies that are employing these technologies at a consumer level. I mean, you know, 23andMe allows you to spit in a bucket and send it off and they'll map your genome for you and put it on the internet or whatever. I mean, are we going to see this really take off as well?
Yeah, I suppose you saw last year James Watson and Craig Venter both published their own genomes. And yeah, genetics is getting more and more and more easy to do. Well, look, we're going to wrap that up there. Synthetic biology clearly is going to have huge numbers of papers and things published, so that's going to be all at guardian.co.uk/science. You can read all about it there. Before we go, let's wind up with a couple more things briefly. Bobby, take us through the fact that later this month we're going to have the biggest computer, was it, in this world or in Britain? It's going to be switched on.
In Britain, yeah. This is called Hector, the high-end computing terascale resource.
Rubbish name.
But basically, it's going to be the fastest supercomputer in Britain, and it will help people do lots of things like modelling air flows and aerodynamics and fluid motion and all these kind of top scale things. Going through the numbers very quickly, it goes at 63 teraflops, which if that means nothing to you, then just brush over it quickly.
A lot of flops.
It's like 12,000 computers kind of all piled in together. And it's got 500 terabytes of memory in there, which is...
Does it run Windows?
I think it only runs Windows XP, not Vista.
Can they really not find anything more interesting to do than look at fluid flow?
Well, this is one of my consistent arguments about high-end computing.
This is very crucial to climate change research, fluid dynamics.
We know how fluid flows, mainly.
No, we don't.
Well, you could take a pretty good guess.
You should not write about anything important, David Allen, if you think that.
I'm with David on this, actually. I think it sounds...
What do you want them to do?
The applications are quite boring.
What do you want them to do?
Well, like, at least in Japanese, they're simulating Earth. I mean, that's kind of, that's what you want to do.
But, you know, it's in Japan. They've
got imagination.
They know about electronics. We're not so keen on it.
I bet this thing is the size of a bus as well, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's in Edinburgh, and it basically takes up like a gym in the university there and just really, really takes up a lot of space.
Well, very good. At least it's...
Is it really in a gym?
I haven't seen it, but it's pretty much along.
It's pretty big, big. Next thing, Ian, astronauts for ESA.
Well, I think I'm going to spend next year running away from Hector when it becomes self-aware and starts plodding around with its valves warming up and stuff like that.
I'm afraid I can't do that, Dave.
Ian, I've got you in my sights.
Go on,
ESA astronauts, quickly.
The interview for me, when I was going to my sixth form college, they asked me what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I said I wanted to be an astronaut.
Science correspondent.
And this year, I'm going to apply to be an astronaut when ESA puts out its call for its new tranche of astronauts to join its astronaut corps.
Can Brits join in?
Well, this is what I would encourage readers to do, actually, because Britain...
Listeners.
Famous, this is what I'd encourage our listeners to do. Is Britain famously puts 0 pence into human spaceflight. But if a lot of us apply, then I think at the moment, according to the queries I've had so far, ESA's obliged to consider our applications. So, you know, they're going to be looking for test pilots,
scientists and engineers. What's the maximum age, though, Ian?
Well, put it like this. A guy going up on the shuttle later this month is 56, has 7 children.
You're pushing it a bit.
You've just
you?
Made it.
I think I might just. Well, I think if you can get
through.
You've
got to go through some training first.
You have to go through a lot of training, which
everyone,
will
that's
last
in February,
year.
Isn't it?
It's going to be probably later than February.
Late
but,
in February. We'll
late spring, early summer.
We'll put the details up on the blog, and everyone should apply, at least to get that brilliant rejection letter that sorry, you can't be an astronaut.
I once applied to be the chairman of the BBC.
Did you? Did you get a rejection letter?
Yeah, but they said they had never received my app. They received it after the deadline. What a swizz.
I applied to be the manager of Manchester City. I told them I had my own tracksuit.
All right, fine. We're going to wrap up by just asking what you guys are working on early next year. Some of the certainties of things we're going to be covering. We've talked a lot about speculative things. David, you're going to go to another climate conference. Is that right?
Well, I'm working very hard on trying to convince...
Another exotic location, is it?
I need to go to the George Bush Major Emitters... Sorry, Major Economies meeting, which is...
And where is it?
It's in Hawaii.
Nice.
You can take your surfboard again.
It was impacted.
Quickly tell us, what's it going to be talking about?
This is George Bush's sort of pet project, George Bush Saves the World, by getting everyone together to talk about climate change, which is what the rest of the world's been doing all the time. He's been sat in the White House.
That's brilliant, isn't it?
But George Bush has now decided that he needs to sell to the audience that he's doing something.
How do you get these? I mean, you know, we all travel for work, but most of us go to these horrible... little rinky-dink places, and you get to go to Bali and Honolulu.
These climate change people.
I need to change jobs.
It's not certain yet, but if the listeners want to lobby the desk that I should go, then I would encourage them to do
so. Well, talking of trips, Bobby, you're going on a couple of trips. Las Vegas?
A couple of days, actually. I'm leaving... for Las Vegas, for the consumer...
Is this just for gambling and hookers?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Bit of cocaine, bit of prostitution.
What are you actually
going to
do any work?
Well. It's actually the Consumer Electronics Show, which is the biggest... Oh, they're all laughing now. The mental image is too much for them. So the Consumer Electronics Show, which is the biggest kind of industry trade show in technology. Everybody gets together every January. Bill Gates... does his Kermit impression on the stage, and then everybody else reveals their new products for the year and everything that's coming up. So I'll be reporting back from that, and you can always tune into the Technology Weekly podcast for a bit of extra. But I'll give some love to you guys as well. Don't worry. And then I roll on to the West Coast and spend a little while in California, hanging around and checking out Silicon Valley.
You people, bastards, all of you. Ian, what are you up to early next year? Are you going back to Florida to try and see the shuttle go up?
Well, I'm hoping to. I'm quite like the Columbus lab, which is Europe's lab, going up to the space station. And so, yeah,
fingers
I'm
crossed,
hoping
it's
to.
It's meant to be going up today, isn't it? January the 2nd.
No, in a week or two's time, we should be going up, provided they get over this damn fuel sensor problem, which has plagued them since Columbia, basically.
Bloody fuel sensor.
But bear in mind, straight after that, there's the huge science conference that one of you two is going to be at that I'm not going to be at in
I will
somewhere nice in America.
Boston.
The AAAS, American
the,
Science.
The American Association for the conference. Advancement of Science.
Yeah.
That's like the American version of the BA, the Radio 1 Roadshow of Science.
Only incomparably better.
It's better. No, it will be better, but there'll be all sorts of... that's where I'm going. I'm going to be going to Boston and reporting daily, blogging heavily, writing incredibly incisive articles. Right, well, that's it for our look ahead to 2008. My thanks to everyone here in the pod for giving up their first proper day of the new year. David Adam, Ian Sample and Bobby Johnson. If you want to have your say on anything we've discussed, head to the Science blog or post a comment on the Facebook wall. May I heartily recommend that you check out The Guardian's other podcasts by heading to guardian.co.uk/podcasts. You'll find our music, football, environment and tech podcasts. Once again, guardian.co.uk/podcasts. Anyway, Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green, and he's worked very, very hard over the past fortnight to make sure you've been receiving your full complement of poddage. That man's a wreck. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.